This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we start the day on Russia and Ukraine, with President Biden less than an hour ago calling Russia's most recent actions of deploying troops to two breakaway regions of eastern Ukraine a, quote, flagrant, end quote, violation of international laws. Biden pointed to this, as well as other Russian actions at the Ukrainian border, as signs of the beginning stages of an invasion.
Russia's moved supplies of blood and medical equipment into position on their border. You don't need blood unless you plan on starting a war.
In response, Biden announced defensive military moves and sanctions. Now, more than 30,000 people in Massachusetts identified as Ukrainian as of 2016, and Congressman Jake Auchincloss has been working with some of them. Auchincloss represents Massachusetts' 4th District, which ranges from Newton to Somerset. Joins us now, Congressman Auchincloss. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me on.
So I should begin by asking you if you had a chance to listen to the president's remarks, Congressman, and if you have any reactions.
It's the president reinforcing his sound diplomacy, and I think it's worth noting the contrast here with the predecessor in that office. In Helsinki in 2018, Trump really laid down before Putin in a performance that John McCain called disgraceful. And now we have a president who's going toe-to-toe with President Putin and is pushing back on his belligerence and his efforts to undermine the post-war international order.
So you talked about diplomatic efforts here. I'm aware you're a former Marine. I'm a child of the 80s, where as kids we sort of expected we might be at war with Russia any day. I don't want to be hyperbolic, but I also don't want to not ask the question, are we at risk of going to war with Russia?
President Biden has made clear that we are not going to have conventional forces engaged in Ukraine in a shooting match with Russia. At the same time, he has been clear that the United States and our NATO allies will wage unprecedented sanctions on Russia if it further invades Ukraine. And it's important, I think, to really underline the stakes here. The post-war rules-based international order that America has really helped support since 45 is something of a miracle in the 2,000-year history of Europe. Europe has usually been at war since the fall of Rome, and for these last several decades, there has been peace and prosperity in the vast majority of the continent. And what Russia is doing now is a direct threat to that post-war stability.
I'm pausing because I want to move to local, and I hear you loud and clear, and yet I find myself struggling to understand in a way that somebody sitting here in the Massachusetts, you know, in Massachusetts, in the Commonwealth, in Boston, Congressman, can understand these stakes. And I'm wondering, help me, help us understand the stakes of the exact moment we're in today. With Russia having made the moves it made yesterday, the president having said the things that just came out of his mouth an hour ago.
One of the things that we prize here in the United States as citizens is the rule of law, about the fact that might does not make right, or at least it shouldn't, and that the most vulnerable amongst us have the same rights and responsibilities as the most powerful. And although we fall short of that aspiration we strive for here in the United States, and we're proud about it, what Russia is doing threatens that conviction on the international stage. It threatens to take us back to an era in which weaker nations were the subject of stronger nations, in which democracies could be overrun by autocracies, and there would be no consequences. And out of the blood and the turmoil of World War II, we made promises. The Allies made promises to one another and to other developing nations that we didn't want to live in a world like that anymore. We wanted to live in a world where peoples could self-determine, as Ukrainian people have, where democracies could thrive, and where the rule of law would run not just within countries, but between them. And Vladimir Putin right now is saying he doesn't accept that. He thinks that Ukraine is part of Russia, which is a gross misreading of history. And he thinks that because Russia is stronger than Ukraine, that he should be able to do what he wants because it's in his near abroad. And we just don't stand for that here.
All right, let's talk now about how that affects some of our neighbors. We've said before, more than 30,000 people identify as Ukrainian in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Last week, we actually spoke with one of your constituents, Olga Lisovska, who now lives in Newton. She mentioned that she and others had met with you to discuss their concerns. What are you hearing from your Ukrainian constituents?
I had a wonderful roundtable that Olga helped organize with Ukrainian Americans from throughout Massachusetts. And I heard several things. One is Ukrainians have a profound sense of self and nationhood. They do not accept this ridiculous assertion by Russia that somehow Russia created Ukraine or that the Ukrainian people are part and parcel of the Russian people. That's just A, historically inaccurate, and B, that is not how the Ukrainian people feel about themselves. Two, they want rule of law and they want their economic development and their political development to be aligned with the European Union and with NATO. That is the aspiration of Ukraine. And finally, I heard from them deep resolve. Ukraine is a nation of more than 40 million people. If Russia invades, they will fight.
So I want to give you a little bit of sound from our conversation with Olga. We talked about her mother, who's an American resident currently stuck in Kyiv.
My mom is stuck now in Kyiv. She's an American resident, you know, permanent resident, and a Ukrainian citizen. And she went back home to just take care of a few things that she needed to do. So she got stuck due to COVID, and now she's stuck due to no-fly zone over Ukraine. So if she were to leave now by herself, even if she did find a way, she doesn't want to leave the loved ones behind.
We heard from Olga just this morning. She says her family's doing okay. They've decided to stay in Kyiv as long as possible. If they have to, they'll drive a car west to a neighboring country. What are the options for families like Olga's right now? By which I mean families, some members are citizens or residents of the U.S., others aren't. These tensions are rising. Russia is starting to move.
Yes, and that's a small window into the unnecessary suffering that Vladimir Putin could unleash here. Ukraine is a country that over the last two decades has been moving towards greater prosperity and freedom, imperfectly, but progress. And Putin could undermine much of that and could cause suffering and need that is not inevitable. It's his decision.
So this is the moment for a congressional office. I mean, you'll do your work in the halls of Congress. You'll, you know, speak publicly about what the president is saying. Clearly, you support that. These phone calls now come in. These are constituents on the ground worried about family members elsewhere. What can your office do for people, you know, sort of right now in this moment?
Well, one of the messages I conveyed to my Ukrainian-American constituents earlier was a relay from the State Department, which was that the State Department is not going to be conducting evacuations of American personnel in Ukraine. And so I encouraged folks starting a few weeks ago that if they had loved ones in the country who wanted to leave or were thinking about leaving, now would be the time to make that decision. My office, as I know every office will do, will do the utmost to connect people with resources and support who find themselves in dire situations.
Other messages you have for people? Again, you know, we have you in a moment. We are in a moment. This is unfolding, you know, 2 hours at a time, 4 hours at a time, 6 hours at a time. Other messages to your constituents right now on this?
America is not a fair weather friend. We are going to support a fledgling sovereign democracy in the face of aggression by a larger autocratic neighbor. And we are going to stand with our NATO allies by pre-deploying forces to the eastern edge of NATO.
All right. I'd like to talk about the sanctions for a minute, Congressman. The president announcing a tranche of sanctions. We'd heard some news about this yesterday and today in response to Russia's move into those eastern territories. As sanctions unfold, will they hit the Massachusetts economy? Will we feel those here in New England, and how?
We have a globalized economy, and there are likely to be repercussions that reverberate throughout the world of sanctions. I think it's likely that Europeans will bear them more directly than Americans will. But yes, they're gonna pinch everybody potentially. It's difficult to determine exactly how. The president, on the front of energy diplomacy in particular, has been moving on several fronts to cushion American consumers from any volatility in energy prices. But these sanctions are meant to be unprecedented in severity, and they are meant to demonstrate to Vladimir Putin that the United States and NATO and indeed some Indo-Pacific countries are going to be allied in levying consequences on him for his flagrant violation of international law.
Will they work? And how stringent do they have to be to work?
They are going to be effective in the direct sense that, for example, asphyxiating Russian imports of high-tech inputs like semiconductor chips is absolutely damaging to their military-industrial complex and to their growing technological sophistication. Canceling the Nord Stream 2 pipeline is very damaging to Russia's oil and gas sector, which is really the prime pump flow for their economy. Levying restrictions on how the Russian elite are able to hoard assets and share assets amongst their family members could undermine Putin's standing with his elite inner circle. So they are going to bite very hard. The challenge is that Vladimir Putin, especially over the last 2 years, has really become increasingly divorced from reality. He has been very isolated. He is increasingly paranoid. He is increasingly obsessed with the idea of restoring Russia's former imperial glory, despite consequences to its economic development. And when somebody edges into irrationality, it is challenging to present a cost-benefit situation to them that, although it's compelling, actually resonates.
Yeah, so we're talking irrationality, and you use you made a reference to asphyxiation. Well, when you asphyxiate somebody, they struggle. They fight back. Do you have concerns about constituents here in Massachusetts facing cyber retaliation from Russia, for example? Are we at risk for that here?
We absolutely need to be on guard, and we've gotten several briefings from CISA, from the federal agency in charge of cyber infrastructure, about their defenses. And it's really a two-part situation. One is we have to work with our critical infrastructure operators to help them get the very best cyber defenses in place, because we have got some very, very good private sector partners who can help keep our critical infrastructure safe, whether that's water or electoral systems or electrical grid systems. But second, we need to have a massive deterrent capability in our offensive cyber forces. And the United States is probably the best in the world at cyber attacks. Now, Americans are unlikely to read about those attacks in the headlines, but they're going to be communicated to Russian leadership that attacks against American cyber infrastructure will be disproportionately.
Okay, last question for you, just briefly. What will you most be watching for in the next, let's say, 24 to 72 hours?
I'll most be watching whether President Putin is looking to support these allegedly independent People's Republics as an off-ramp from this escalation, as a way for him to save face at home and not invade the rest of Ukraine, or whether he's using these troop movements into these two separatist republics as the pretext for a larger invasion. We're at a fork in the roads where he's either looking for an off-ramp or whether he is massing forces in preparation for a larger offensive. And that's what I'm most watching.
All right. That is United States Congressman Jake Auchincloss, who represents Massachusetts' 4th District. I appreciate you giving us the time. Thanks. For the first time in more than 700 days, yes, I said 700 days, the general public can walk the halls of the Massachusetts State House today, which means for the first time in almost 2 years, you could hear folks like George guiding tourists through the storied halls.
Now, we have this replica fish, let's call it, which we refer to as the sacred cod. And a long time ago, miraculously, this cod disappeared. Now, that's a big taboo here in Massachusetts, and so there was kind of a statewide manhunt for this fish. Now, they were able to roughly...
Ah, the sacred cod. WBUR State House reporter Steve Brown in the State House, which is now open to the public, joins us. Steve, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, Tiziana.
All right, so Steve, you are a member of the press. You're vaccinated. You've had access all along. This is the place that conducts the people's business. What is it like to have the people back after more than 700 days?
Sure. There's a different sound to the building. You can hear talking and murmuring throughout these marble halls. That is what kind of made things so eerie for 2 years here. Having this big cavernous building, more or less to myself, was kind of strange. Of course, there were some key staffers who were in the building throughout the pandemic and some other reporters. But overall, it was deadly quiet most of that time. I can now feel a little bit more life coming back into the building. I don't know if you can hear in the background, some folks talking off in the distance and footsteps and what have you. We haven't heard that for 2 years.
You know, you said a second ago you can hear human beings talking, which just kind of blows my mind with a state house. Had there been tension in the last few months, Steve, about whether or not to open the state house, or was the legislature pretty clear, we are good with this place shut for now?
I think they were pretty satisfied with the way things were. The legislative leadership was saying, you know, we're keeping it closed because we have to keep the staff, the 600 people that work in this building, safe. But obviously, as time went on and we saw more city and town halls opening up and malls and supermarkets and Boston Garden and all these places opening up, this was the last holdout.
So was there a line today of people waiting with the door, you know, at the doors to open?
No. the building did open at 9 a.m. There was one lobbyist who was the first to enter. But for several minutes after that, there were more reporters hanging around the entrance than real people. That changed as the day went on. I did catch up with Belinda Byrne, who was visiting from San Francisco. She was taking the first official State House tour.
I would have been really disappointed if I couldn't see this. It really gives a real flavor of Boston. It really resonates in terms of the historical context.
Now, she was quite impressed with all the murals and sculptures that are all throughout the building. Of course, one of the great things about coming to work in a building like the State House is it's part seat of the government as well as part museum. It's nice to see it through the eyes of a visitor from time to time.
And what are the protocols for visitors now?
Sure, everyone must wear a mask. All visitors have to show that they have been fully vaccinated against COVID, or if not, produce a COVID test from within 24 hours showing that they are negative for the virus.
So I'm noting that's beginning today. There are cities and towns around the Commonwealth that are actually lifting their indoor mask mandates. Boston and Salem just lifted their requirements for proof of vaccination. So any indication how long these measures might last at the State House?
Legislative leaders have said that they will revisit the guidelines weekly. Now, with the infection rates dropping, I don't think they're going to be keeping the vaccination check in place for too long, especially with other places like the Boston Garden and those cities and towns that you mentioned dropping the vaccination requirement.
So I know many legislative committee hearings have been virtual. Is that still going to be the case, or are we back to in-person hearings?
They are encouraging folks to still participate virtually. The way that the legislative calendar works, though, most hearings on bills have already been completed for this session. Now, there'll be a hearing here or there as things come up. But for the most part, hearing season is off until 2023. So we'll see where things stand then.
And what are the big priorities the legislature is working on right now, Steve?
Well, the fiscal 23 budget is the biggie right now. The budget always sucks all the oxygen out of the building the first half of every year. The Ways and Means Committees are finishing up hearings. The full House will take it up in late April. The Senate deals with it in May, and then they try to come up with a compromise by July 1st. But usually that agreement is reached a little while after the deadline. The Senate still has to take up the bill that was passed last week that would allow undocumented immigrants to obtain a Massachusetts driver's license. And the legislative leaders in both branches have their own priorities that they would like to see completed by the time they wrap things up the end of July.
All right. We will continue to check in with you as you report on those. Steve, WBUR State House reporter Steve Brown. From Beacon Hill today, Steve, thanks.
Thank you, Tiziana.
It is Tuesday, so it is time to ask some coronavirus questions. And we have a bunch this week. So we're focused on this big question of pandemic COVID versus endemic COVID. Where are we in that transition? Are wide changes in masking policies ahead of the curve, behind the curve, right on time? What does it take to boost boosters, meaning both getting more people to get the shot and when we might need to boost ourselves with a new booster again? So much to ask. So with us now, Dr. Gabriela Andujar Vazquez, infectious disease physician and associate hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center. Dr. Andujar Vazquez, welcome back to Radio Boston. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me. Always happy to be here.
Oh, and we're glad to have you. We have a lot of questions of our own this week, Doctor, so I'm going to stick with you and me, but next week we will open up the phones to callers again. So let's start with Boston Mayor Michelle Wu's move to eliminate the city's vaccine, proof of vaccination requirement. Right time to do that? Too fast? Bit of both? What do you think?
I think that we're in a point now, thankfully, where, you know, cases are down. We went through that big surge in the winter, December and January. I think it is the right time to start pulling back on a lot of the things that were put in place during, you know, a time where we were seeing increasing cases and we needed to sort of layer up on more of the things that we know by now we should be doing to protect each other.
Do you feel like pulling back on those measures now is an important part psychologically to keeping people in the sort of compliance game in terms of keeping each other safe in the
absolutely.
Long run?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, we're getting to a point, and I think you alluded a little bit in the introduction to this topic, that where we are sort of trying to balance that risks, individual risks versus community risk, public health risk. And when we see cases that are going down and, you know, we can try to at least predict a little bit of when that would trigger, you know, what things would trigger cases to go up and what we need to do. I think that we're in a point where we have to balance the mental health and the ability for people to be compliant, right? Like you said, like it's hard to just, you know, be at home, do nothing, not be able to do anything for, you know, for an indefinite period of time. And I think it's not something that's necessary anymore. I think we know a bit more every day on how to handle this, you know, virus.
So, you know, for a while now, several weeks, we've had conversations, heard conversations about this continuum from a pandemic to something endemic. I mean, it's with us and we learn to live with it. Last Friday, we had Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley on air, and I asked her where she thought we were in that evolution, for lack of a better word. And she said, you know, we would love to be done with COVID, but COVID is not done with us. And she really came down quite firmly. We're still in the pandemic era here. Do you agree, A, and how do we know when we've crossed from a pandemic to something we learn to live with?
Right. I think that's the challenging part, because it's not like one day we're in a pandemic and the next day we're endemic, right? And I think it's something that's of a continuum where different things have to happen before we even call something endemic. You know, for example, you know, we would have never thought of calling this endemic at all before vaccines were available, right? We wouldn't even before even the vaccines thought of calling it endemic, because we know that the virus was new to humans, right? And that we at the very, very beginning we had to learn how it transmit. We learned that we had to learn how to mitigate that transmission, right, and break that chain of cycle of infection, and then jumping to vaccines, you know, and developing therapeutics. Availability of treatment is part of one of the components of when we might be able to call a novel organism endemic or not. And then, so, you know, the congressman was right in that we are still in that sort of in between part where we know that we probably won't be in the next years, won't eradicate completely this virus, right? We know that now, as a year and a half maybe ago, we weren't that sure if that was going to be the case. We thought that maybe we could eliminate it as it happened with SARS-CoV-1, right? MERS and the other SARS viruses that were kind of completely eradicated, but this didn't happen in this case. And so now we're in that transition part of this continuum between when we can definitely call it endemic. And, you know, we're still behind in the efforts on vaccination globally, efforts on access to therapeutics equitably. So I think there's a long way to go in terms of access to a lot of the things that I just mentioned. But at least in mitigation risk for us and an individual, I think we have the tools to be able to protect ourselves and others. And we just have to remember that this will change, right? That right now we're lifting certain things, but maybe in spring or in summer, that may be different. And we have to learn how to slowly be able to live with that.
So we have the technology to protect the individual from serious risk or harm and to treat COVID. And that moves us towards the endemic. But on a global scale, we don't have the uptake, the distribution, the supply that we need to get it to everyone. And that keeps us vulnerable to pandemic. Is that basically what you're saying?
Yeah, that is exactly it. And, you know, within our own communities, we know that they're still vulnerable, all right? And there will always be, right? We know that as we compare, for example, COVID with other viruses that like flu or other, you know, respiratory syncytial viruses, things that are more deadly or more severe in certain age groups or certain vulnerable populations like weak immune system patients, we know that there are layers to this and that for the general population, there might be an individual risk that's more acceptable than for certain populations that are not there yet. And that's understandable. I mean, like if I was, an elderly patient and also with medical problems that weaken my immune system, I know that I need to protect myself and probably more so than any other individual around me. And so that's the key, that's the challenge, balancing the needs for those that are most vulnerable versus, you know, the mental health and balance of society, right, within a pandemic. So
we are asking the doctor here on Radio Boston with Gabriela Andujar-Vazquez, an infectious disease physician and associate hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center. I want to talk about a couple of pain points now. We'll do a couple political pain points. We'll do a couple medical pain points. I'm holding a KF94 in my hands, the one I wear at work. I change it every few days. It's more comfortable than some of the masks I've worn in the past. I don't know when I get to take it off at work. Lots of people don't know when they get to take their masks off. But some cities and towns, for example, are saying you don't have to do that inside anymore. Why are masks a flashpoint? And when do we get to the point where they stay home?
Right. Yeah, I think that one, we're definitely, in terms of masks, we're definitely there where we just blankly do not recommend certain populations to wear a mask to protect themselves. One thing that, you know, we have to remember, if you're unvaccinated, that's where you are most vulnerable or most at risk of contracting the virus and also to transmitting to others. So that patient population that has not gotten a single dose of a vaccine are sort of in a different group clinically and I think, from public health perspective in regards to masks. But now once you're fully vaccinated and boosted, that risk for yourself and decreases. And if the risk for you to have infection decreases significantly, then it also automatically decreases the risk for you to transmit, right? Because mm-hmm. you're less likely to get infected, even though we know with the Omicron variant that's more circulating mostly in the U.S. that, you know, that effectiveness of that vaccine towards infection did decrease significantly the past couple of weeks, with or without booster. But in terms of mask, I think we're at the point where we are able to lift all those mandates that are like broad, statewide or citywide, and mainly go to an advisory where we are encouraging people to protect themselves, with especially the ones that are vulnerable that I just mentioned, right? Unvaccinated, and consider having a well-fitted mask that's comfortable. But I think that we are in debate on whether exactly we would consider to lift all mask mandates, for example, in public transportation and other areas where it's still something that it hasn't been discussed of when we would do that.
But in general, it sounds like you're saying we're at the moment where it's time for mask wearing to be about personal safety and personal choice, supported
exactly.
when people want to do it, but no longer mandated by government.
Exactly.
So you talked at the beginning of that answer about how much more at risk we are when unvaccinated. Here in the Commonwealth, 77% of the state fully vaccinated, but that leaves 23%. We understand some of that as kids, and we still have an age cohort of kids that even can't be vaccinated. But for those adults who can and could have been, and it's been a long time now, are we ever going to move the needle with them? I'm sorry, no pun intended there. Or is this just where we are now?
I'm hoping, I was looking at numbers from the CDC nationwide. And actually, in those age groups that are young adults between 12 and 30-ish, we are seeing a small daily increase in first doses. And I don't know if that is just like a post-Omicron, now I feel like I should get the vaccine or not. I'm not entirely sure personally on why we're seeing a small, but I'm hopeful that, at this point that the individuals that have held back that can get a vaccine are eligible due to age and have no medical contraindications to get a first dose, that do get it, because there's plenty of data now. And we have a two fully approved vaccines now, Pfizer and Moderna, approved at the FDA. And, with so much data availability now. And so I would really, and it's clear that if you're unvaccinated, no matter the age, you're extreme risk for severe illness, right? So I really hope that the needle could be moved a little bit, but I wonder what would make that happen after, a year of and a couple of months of this vaccine being available in the U.S.
Well, that is Dr. Gabriela Andujar-Vazquez, infectious disease physician and associate hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center, and often generous with her time doing Ask the Doctors with us here on Radio Boston. Doctor, as usual, thanks for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Lots of hard stuff happening in the world today, and we're going to end with one that's coming home, and it begins with a warning.
Current and future emissions matter, but this will happen no matter what we do about emissions. This report is a wake-up call for the United States, but it's a wake-up call that comes with a silver lining.
I will take a silver lining on a wake-up call. That is Rick Spinrad, administrator of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, talking last week about a new report on the state of sea level rise. The report presents 5 predictions for the level of sea level rise that will happen between now and 2100. At the low end of the scale, so low-end scenario, we could see as little as 2 feet. On the high end, 7. So imagine, more than your couch underwater right now. The report says that our actions today will determine how much it rises, but they won't stop it. Sea level rise is coming. We are now in an age, it argues, that it is, inevitable. So here to talk more about what this rise in sea level means for our coastal and inland residents here in Massachusetts and ways that we can lessen the inevitable's impacts, we have Rebecca Hurst. She is the director of the Sustainable Solutions Lab at UMass Boston, and Andrew Gottlieb. He is the executive director of the Association to Preserve Cape Cod. Rebecca, welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And Andrew, welcome back to you as well.
Good to be here with you.
All right, so Rebecca, 2 feet of water. Help us get our heads around how much that is. What does that look like?
So if we have, when we think about the flooding that we had in 2018, when we had 2 1% chance floods in just 2 months, that amount of flooding we could see at mid-century with 1 foot of sea level rise happening much, much more frequently. So when we see 2 feet of sea level rise, you know, it's even more than that. And when we get to 5 or 6 feet of sea level rise by the end of the century, we could see that amount of flooding twice daily at high tide.
No, that's okay. Yeah, go ahead. No. Go ahead and finish your thought.
Well, just if we don't do anything, much of the coast would no longer be livable.
Okay, so that's so interesting, Rebecca, because what you're saying is, okay, as a layperson on this subject, when you tell me a lot of water, right, the water's coming up, what I think about is how deep it gets. But what you're saying is this is also frequency of when it's going to hit us, and that both are associated with this sea level rise, right?
Exactly. And what I was just talking about was like sunny day flooding, not thinking about adding in a storm on top of that.
So, Andrew, I'm going to be deliberately obtuse here for just a second. Sunny day flooding is a thing?
Sunny day flooding is currently a thing. We have already seen increases in tide levels as a result of warming that has occurred over the last couple of centuries and is accelerating. So we're already seeing in places like Shore Road and Falmouth, sort of an iconic coastal road, probably 10 or 12 times a year on high tides, on bright sunny days or moonlit nights, when that roadway becomes flooded. That is going to occur more and more. And in fact, the long-term 30-year plan for the town of Falmouth is to abandon that road because it will be underwater so frequently.
So, Rachel, I'm going to play a little sound on this subject. We spoke with your colleague, Ellen Douglas, who's professor of hydrology in the School for the Environment at UMass Boston. Here she is.
Even if we didn't have a change in storms, with increased sea level rise, these storm surges, which are basically a big pile of water that the winds push ahead of a storm, they'll just reach farther inland. So we would have increased flooding.
So basically, I mean, again, I think the layperson tends to think you have a flood when it rains a lot and then the water comes up. But this is, hey, on a bad day, a windy day with the sun out, boom, here it comes just because of general sea level rise. Is that right?
Yes. And when there is a storm, you know, it goes in even further. Right. So, and I think as you're saying, you know, often when we're thinking about sea level rise, we really think of just water on top of the land and where we are. But this also impacts our, you know, saltwater intrusion, like it impacts the water table. So there would be more flooding of basements, harder to drain after a storm, wastewater issues. So there's lots of different implications to having additional sea level rise much higher.
So, Andrew, I want to get my mind around what this means for coastal communities on the Cape, which are treasures for all of us. And, of course, we imagine them being particularly vulnerable. Is it just houses and basements? What else do we see as long-term damage or impact here?
No, in many respects, it's everything. So it's beaches. A lot of our beaches, obviously, are low-lying and close to sea level. And there'll be loss of those beach areas, further dune erosion, a lot of the municipal parking lots that provide easy access to vacationing and year-round population to the beach. Those will be either gone or underwater with great frequency. There'll be an effort among many property owners to armor the shoreline under their homes at the bottom of the bank. And what we found, given armoring in the past, where people put hard structures up to protect their land from erosion, is that the beach underneath it disappears. Mm. So what we could be looking at is a Cape without beaches or without ready access to beaches. In addition, a lot of our low-lying areas, the coastal marshes, provide a multitude of environmental services, from flood protection to flood storage, habitat for fin fisheries and birds and migrating fowl. And those resources, those marshes are not going to be able to migrate inland with the speed at which we're expecting sea level to rise. So we're going to lose a lot of marsh habitat. That means that flood waters that we're going to be stored in those marshes under typical and normal circumstances has to go somewhere. And that somewhere is onto roads, public infrastructure, and people's property. So, you know, not only do we lose the flood storage capability, we're also going to lose a lot of environmental habitat, breeding grounds, and become a much less robust environment as a result.
Okay, so Andrew, at the beginning, I talked about those five levels of scenarios, right? With a low scenario to a high potential scenario, the low at least is coming. So the habitat stuff you just talked about, I think I hear you saying that's just coming no matter what. Is that right?
Yeah, there's an awful lot of warming and melting and sea level rise that are cooked into the atmosphere and cooked into the equation now.
And the no beaches on the Cape thing?
Well,
I'm assuming that's more on the high end of this potential
spectrum. That tends to come on the high end, but it also comes from decisions that we're going to make about how we're managing the uplands above these coastal marsh area and coastal dune areas. You know, and embedded in that is a discussion and that we haven't really had very well yet about what our response is going to be in terms of relocating facilities, relocating homes. To what extent are we going to invest anything and everything to protect a home for a short period of time and lose the beach underneath it? So the Cape really, along with the rest of the coastal regions, has to come to grips with that reality and make some decisions and decide what we want to look like in the future.
Do you have time to have that discussion and make those decisions?
Certainly there is time remaining. I think that we are late to the conversation. I think most towns have only now begun to grapple with what's likely to come. There are some great tools that have been done. This NOAA report provides some ability to look forward. Cape Cod Commission has an interesting tool, a coastal planner tool on their website that lets you look at segments and begin to play with different levels of sea level rise, where the flooding is going to be, where the slosh zones are going to be, and what our options are. And you already see towns, Sandwich, they're relocating their police and fire station from the coastal area of Route 6A inland because of increased flooding and frequency of flooding that we're already experiencing. Towns, Brewster and Orleans, have looked at moving back parking lots. So it's already happening. It's happening in a disjointed way. I think this study helps crystallize that we're either going to adapt or we're going to lose facilities and we're going to have an uncontrolled change to our landscape.
Okay, turning back to you now, Rebecca Hurst of the Sustainable Solutions Lab at UMass Boston. We spoke with Paul Kirshen, who is the director of the Stone Living Lab at UMass Boston, about this idea that this is going to affect a lot of people on the coast, but what about people much deeper inland? And he made the case for why this matters basically to everyone. Here he is.
Boston Harbor no longer existed. Everything that comes into Boston Harbor wouldn't get into the inland communities. Also, the coast, particularly in Massachusetts, is really important for our tourism and recreation. And many of the people in the inland communities commute into Boston. So what happens in Boston really impacts really all of New England.
So, Rebecca, when I hear it's going to hit everybody, then I hear what I've learned about environmental justice, which is when an environmental impact hits everybody, it hits the people who are most vulnerable and most marginalized first and harder. Is that the case
here?
Yes,
exactly.
So talk about that.
Definitely. So I think it's helpful to think about both chronic stressors and more disruptive shocks when we're thinking about the way that climate change is playing a role in our lives. So chronic stressors with sea level rise are things like flood insurance going up and then being that cost being passed on to renters, or basements flooding more often and people not being able to waterproof them and having molds in apartments and causing more asthma. In Miami, we're seeing that areas that were traditionally less desirable because they were on higher ground and farther from the water are now having property prices skyrocket as people realize that they need to move away from the coast. So there are lots of different chronic stressors that really can play a role in people's lives and the ways that sea level rise will impact the city as a whole. And that's not even thinking about, you know, a big disaster, a big storm with catastrophic impacts. So when we think about a catastrophic storm, if we're thinking about both before the storm, during the storm, and after the storm, there are all sorts of ways that historically marginalized communities get the short end of the stick. We have a faculty member, Roslyn Negron, who's doing research on how social ties influence people's decision-making for how to evacuate with Hurricane Maria, you know, and who had access to being able to evacuate or not. You know, if you don't speak English as a first language or don't have a car to leave, don't have money for a hotel, you know, you might stay during a storm. Mm. And then during a storm, we did some research with a report called Views That Matter, Race and Opinions on Climate Change in Greater Boston, and found that, unfortunately, white respondents were much more likely to have, you know, multiple days of prescriptions or an evacuation plan or backup power or flood insurance, you know, different things that are, you know, extra food. So there are all these things that, like, in the first few days or, like, in the immediacy of a storm that people don't have access to. And then after a storm, there's even more issues, right? Like, we know that for figuring out how to rebuild, applying for federal aid, there's lots and lots of things to navigate that are really challenging. And research showed after Harvey in Texas that the racial wealth gap widened in communities that were hit. The wealth gap between homeowners and renters widened. The wealth gap between people with more education and less education widened. But what was particularly upsetting to me about that study was that places that had FEMA aid had wider gaps than places that didn't. And that's just awful. Like, the point of having aid is not to make the rich richer, but to ensure that everybody can be safe and healthy. So as we're thinking about these impacts, we need to be really intentional about what are the policies, what are the programs, how are we making sure that everybody can be safe.
All right. Thank you for that. And in our last, just in a sentence or two, Andrew, the call to action for communities right now.
I think it's coming to grips with reality and, you know, engaging our community and our public in some difficult conversations about where we can hold our ground and where we have to retreat and adjust and adapt so that future generations will be able to enjoy a changed Cape Cod in a way that bears any resemblance to the current Cape Cod we all grew up and fell in love with.
All right. Andrew Gottlieb is the executive director of the Association to Preserve Cape Cod. And Rebecca Hurst is the director of the Sustainable Solutions Lab at UMass Boston. Andrew, thank you.
Thank you.
And Rebecca, thanks to you as well.
Thanks so much.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick and Amanda Beeland. We had help today from Francisca Monahan, Sarah Leeson, and Matt Ledden. Marquise Neal's our technical director, Karen Schiffman, our interim executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.